Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics Podcast. I'm Karina Wu. Medicines aren't just available for life-threatening or painful conditions. A different breed of medicines, dubbed lifestyle drugs, can do such things as help you grow a better crop of hair or liven up your sex life. But developing and testing such drugs pose a challenge. Is enough known about the conditions they're meant to treat? And what's the best way to measure the effectiveness of such drugs in the clinic? I've been talking to two scientists who are involved in research that addresses these questions. Carl Spana is president and CEO of Palatin Technologies in New Jersey. In an article in the January issue of CPT, he and his team discussed drugs for female sexual dysfunction, or FSD. I started by asking him how female sexual dysfunction is defined.
Well, the general definition of female sexual dysfunction is that a patient will have a deficit or lack in some aspect of the female sexual response cycle. And it may be permanent, it may be transient, but they generally have some deficit in the female sexual response cycle.
So how is FSD diagnosed?
It initiates by the patient's own self-determination. They feel that they're either not becoming as aroused as they used to, they don't reach orgasm as quickly as they used to or as intensely, or the level of desire doesn't feel normal, and in this context we mean normal in their own eyes. Then at that juncture, as they come in to seek treatment, they then can go through a formal diagnostic paradigm in which they will answer questionnaires as well as meeting with sexual psychologists, which can establish a formal definition of female sexual dysfunction.
So what current treatment options are there for FSD?
Well, the most common treatment option available today is generally sexual therapy. If you have ruled out that the patient's cause of their sexual dysfunction isn't due to taking certain antidepressants or isn't due to the fact that they have a faulty relationship, or there may be an abusive relationship, for example, once those types of things are ruled out, the options that are left today are really to engage in some form of sexual therapy, which certainly can have some success in treating sexual dysfunction. But today there are no FDA-approved treatment options for women.
But are there any medications that are currently prescribed for FSD?
There are some medications that are prescribed off-label. One of the more common ones is low-dose testosterone, which can be given quite commonly to women that have low libido or low desire. Beyond that, there aren't too many other medications that are tried.
Why is it so difficult to develop specific drugs to treat FSD?
One of the biggest challenges in developing drugs to treat FSD is that what constitutes a normal response. So for some women, they may have sexual intercourse 3 or 4 times a month. Others may have 10 times a month. Their level of overall satisfaction with their sexual activities may be relatively high. Maybe 50 or 60% of the time they have sexual intercourse, they are satisfied but don't feel normal. Other times it may be zero. So you have a lot of potential variability in how the patient perceives their sexual dysfunction and what it is that they're trying to achieve. And when we run a clinical trial, we, of course, are trying to get a more uniform patient population, and we're trying to use measurement devices that allow us to characterize or capture a potential treatment benefit. So I think many times we are probably underestimating the overall efficacy of some of the treatments that we're using because of the variability in the overall patient population and the way they respond to the medication and the way we actually measure efficacy.
How exactly is efficacy measured in clinical trials?
The tools generally fall into two common categories. They are counting tools, for example, like a diary or an event log in which the patient captures every time they have a sexual encounter with their partner, they capture their level of satisfaction with that encounter. And you can tabulate that at a baseline measurement, what their level of satisfaction was with their sexual experiences or encounters. And then as a function of treatment over time, you can then capture if that number is going up. So they're having more satisfying sexual encounters. That's one of the primary measurements that are done. And that's a very simple counting or event log. The other way that it's also done is through validated self-assessment questionnaires. So these are questionnaires that will probe, for example, overall sexual satisfaction or probe patient's level of desire or arousal, and they have been designed and developed by sexual psychologists so that they are instruments that have been tested in both normal and disease patients and have been validated to actually distinguish between a normal patient population and a disease patient population. And those are generally done in 4-week increments, meaning that they're given at a baseline period, and then every 4 weeks of treatment, the patient refills out those questionnaires. And we can capture if a treatment is actually affecting a level of desire or arousal using these types of instruments as well. So there are two ways in which it's done.
So what can be done to improve the design of clinical trials?
Well, that's a $64,000 question. I think there are a couple of things that can be done. Certainly, the more experience that we generate in actually doing larger prospective clinical trials that are well-controlled, that have better defined patient populations, the more experience we'll have, and I think through that process we'll get a little more precise in the way that clinical trials are done. In addition to that, the more academic work that's done to better characterize what is normal, how do you capture a response in a patient? Those are the kind of things that I think where you can begin to see potentially an opening up or making it a little bit easier to develop. I mean, the tools that we have today may not be perfect, but they certainly work to capture a signal. They, just as I said, may, in my estimation, underestimate what the actual signal or benefit is to the patient.
All right. Thank you for speaking with us, Dr. Spana.
Thank you as well.
One current concern relating to drugs for sexual dysfunction is that they could be abused. For example, some teenagers report using drugs for erectile dysfunction, even though this problem is uncommon among teens. Timothy Apodaca is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine and a staff psychologist at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. He's written about the issues surrounding teen drug use in the January CPT. I called him to learn more. Dr. Apodaca, what kinds of prescription drugs are teenagers misusing?
Pretty much any medication that can have an effect on how they feel or think is a possible candidate for abuse for teens. What we see most of are things like some of the pain medications, oxycodone, Vicodin, but also more and more we're seeing the benzodiazepines are sort of making a comeback. We're seeing a lot of abuse of things like Xanax, those kinds of meds. Those are becoming much more widespread. Also, some of the stimulant medications used to treat ADHD, seeing a fair amount of abuse there. The most widely abused one currently is probably Adderall.
So what kinds of drugs were you focusing on in this study?
One of the things that we were interested in taking a look at was, what about medications that don't provide some sort of psychotropic effect like those others, but medications for erectile dysfunction? Most people don't associate teens or adolescents as needing that type of medication, but this is so widespread in the media and sort of the public consciousness, we figured that the curiosity and sometimes sensation or thrill-seeking of teens might lead them to want to try something like that.
Where do teenagers get access to these drugs?
Primarily through either family or friends. What we found in looking at this is that about two-thirds of the time or more, it actually comes from family or friends. If it comes from friends, they're usually given to the teenager or perhaps purchased. If it comes from a family member, a father, grandfather, an uncle, almost universally they've been stolen. And in fact, when they get it from a friend, most likely the friend has also stolen it from one of their family members. So they're pretty much taking it from somebody else in the house for whom the medication was originally prescribed.
How widespread is this problem?
Well, specific to the ED drugs, it's a small issue. It's not a large number. It's kind of hard to get good hard data on this, but one study that we were able to locate found that about 5 to 6% of teens or young adult males, this is an early college survey that we found, so about 5% report that they have used that wasn't prescribed to them. So it's fairly small. Most of the other medications that we see being abused, like we mentioned earlier, the benzos or the stimulants or the painkillers, abuse rates there run from anywhere from 5 to 10% of teens. So it's kind of on the lower end.
Are there particular concerns for teens abusing ED drugs?
One of the concerns is that it seems to be clustered with a variety of risky behaviors, such as other drug use or alcohol use, risk-taking behavior. So the main concern really is risky sexual behavior, having sex with multiple partners, having unprotected sex, sort of already a group that's at risk of not making the most healthy sexual decisions because of lack of experience and some of that risk-taking. And when you add an erectile dysfunction drug to the mix, it has the potential to put them at risk for more sexual experiences than perhaps they had originally intended, more partners, and risk of sexually transmitted infections.
So what are some of the challenges of studying this problem?
Well, when it involves getting to anybody under the age of 18, the difficulty comes in most institutional review boards require parental consent for a minor to participate in research. And that makes sense in the vast majority of cases. But when you're studying something that's a sensitive topic like sexual behavior or drug use, it's pretty likely that the teen is going to be intimidated to either not participate or to provide not false data, but perhaps not be as forthcoming as they might be otherwise if their parents are going to know about it. And so the way it's set up generally is that parents have to be told what the study is about and what the teen is going to be asked about. And the concern is that teens would be reluctant to participate in this study of this type, or that we'd sort of not get a representative sample.
So what can be done on the part of parents and doctors to help prevent this kind of misuse?
I think the first key is to acknowledge that this is happening on some level. It's not widespread, but it's happening, and it's a risk. So acknowledging it and then being forthright with it, doctors talking to their patients, parents talking to their kids, that these medications have potential for abuse. So when the medication is first prescribed or refilled, the doctors could make sure that they talk to their adult patients for whom they're prescribing this and alert them. Hey, sometimes teens get access to this stuff. Are there teens in the home? Discuss a plan for how to keep track of those medications, because as we've seen, most of the medications that end up in the hands of teens, that they're stolen. They take them from family members. Perhaps a tagline on some of the advertisements alerting to the problem of teen misuse of these prescription drugs, and just controlling the flow of where these medications end up.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with us.
Sure. It's been a pleasure.
Those two articles from Apodaca and Spana are available on the CPT website at www.nature.com/CPT, alongside other articles in the January issue on sex and lifestyle drugs. I'm Karina Wu. Thanks for listening.